Good afternoon, it's Mountain Edition. I'm Allison Bektesh.
And I'm Elizabeth Stewart-Severy. As you can tell, the Valley is operating at max capacity.
Which means the airport has all hands on deck helping with safety and security.
It's the new year and time for some reflections.
We hear from Aspen's mayor, who has announced a bid for a third term.
And despite all those fairy tales, wolves are not evil.
Those stories and more coming up on Mountain Edition.
The week between Christmas and New Year's is one of the busiest of the year at the Aspen-Pitkin County Airport, and also one of the most dangerous.
It takes a separate set of skills to handle the air side of snow removal and the land side, making sure both the planes and the runways are safe for takeoff and landing. Airport Director John Kinney says the 1,500 daily passengers this time of year require a more than 200% increase in staff. Almost 50 people have been hired for the winter season. There are also 10 additional transportation security agents to handle the busier times, paid for and managed directly by the TSA.
All those visitors to Aspen and Snowmass will stay here for the next few days, placing the resort at peak occupancy. Tuesday morning, there was one hotel room available in town. It's probably gone now, but Bill Tomsich from the Central Reservations Agency Stay Aspen Snowmass says last-minute cancellations are pretty much a visitor's only shot at a night in the Upper Valley for the rest of the week. These numbers do not take into account what might be available through vacation rental sites like Airbnb. Locals can expect to see an exodus on New Year's Day and January 2nd, but Aspen and Snowmass will remain at about 80% of capacity, up 15 points from last year.
A program to help sexual assault victims get adequate physical care in the Tri-County area has been resurrected after 4 years. Carolyn Zachariasen reports.
One of the last efforts Sherry Kaloya has made before she steps down as a district attorney for the 9th Judicial District next month is reestablishing the Sexual Assault Nurse Examiner, or SANE, program. Her office announced this week that examinations for sex assault victims will be done at the Garfield County Public Health Office in Rifle. It's at this location where three nurses are qualified to conduct SANE exams. Prior to this, victims had to travel as far as Grand Junction or Summit County to get treated. Carolyn Zachariasen, Aspen Public Radio News.
If there were ever to be a disease outbreak in Pitkin County that overwhelmed the hospital, there is a team ready to set up a temporary public health facility using a medical surge trailer.
The trailer is equipped with basic medical supplies, cots, and IVs. The Pitkin County Public and Environmental Health Department recently reorganized the equipment, with the goal that anyone who would need to set up an alternate care site would be able to quickly find and access all the supplies. It's possible that this small community with limited access and high volumes of international visitors could experience an outbreak of something like H1N1 or another infectious disease that would overwhelm local health facilities.
This fall, Valley 7th grader Ella Lindenberg took it upon herself to be the change she wants to see in the world. Lindenberg spoke with Allison about her One Girl fundraising efforts to help girls in Kenya stay in school.
When you're talking about the organization, how do you present it? What's your pitch for getting people to get involved?
When I was kind of asking people to donate, I told them that I'm working with a nonprofit organization called For the Good Period, and it helps provide girls with adolescent kits that have two pairs of underwear and 8 reusable pads. So they don't have to worry about their puberty showing. So I'd ask them for a donation and if they could help at all.
Isn't it scary going and talking to people about periods?
It is kind of scary talking to people about this topic, but I feel like I'm more of a mature tween, I guess what you'd call our group of children. But it's just really cool that I was able to do this. I was able to talk to adults and my teachers and other kids about this topic without freaking out. It was just interesting knowing that, and also the way I felt like the way I was talking, not many kids or the teachers were kind of thinking this as a joke, like this was a real thing. There are kids, girls, across the Atlantic not going to school because of puberty hitting them. It's just, I was mature about it. I was calm. It was an interesting ride.
And you are one of the few probably middle schoolers who heard that people couldn't go to school and felt sorry for them instead of feeling jealous of them.
Oh, I would never feel jealous about kids not going to school. I mean, this is a serious thing. Having your education is so important in your life. And I'm not jealous. I'm more sad for them because they don't get to go because of natural stuff. And I like going to school, and they can't.
That was Glenwood Springs middle schooler Ella Lindenberg. She helped raise more than $1,000 through a bake sale for the local nonprofit For the Good Period.
Atlantic Aviation runs the Rifle Airport, and they're sinking some serious money in for upgrades. Aspen Public Radio's Wyatt Orm has the details.
The Rifle Airport has a new 30,000-square-foot hangar. It's heated. It also has office space. Atlantic Aviation redesigned the airport's lobby and its pilot's lounge. According to a press release from Garfield County, now both have more, quote, elegant Mountain Lodge decor, end quote. Rifle is a busy airport. At times, it's the third busiest in the state in terms of private aviation. Many planes are diverted to Rifle from other airports when the weather is bad. In 2016, Garfield County pitched in $4 million and gave the airport a new entrance. Wyatt Orm, Aspen Public Radio News.
This is Mountain Edition on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Allison Bektesh. To stay up to date with news in the Roaring Fork Valley, follow us on social media. Like us on Facebook, find Aspen Pub Radio on Twitter, or follow us on Instagram. Aspen Public Radio, your news, your music, your station. The city of Aspen has filed to keep conditional water rights on Castle and Maroon Creeks because, council members say, the town may one day need water storage. But environmental groups American Rivers and Wilderness Workshop are taking their opposition to those rights to court. Matt Rice is the Colorado Basin Director for American Rivers. He and Wilderness Workshop's Will Rausch told Elizabeth that the public needs to better understand what these conditional rights actually mean.
What are some of your primary concerns about the effects on Castle and Maroon Creeks?
Well, it's well documented and clearly proven over time that dams have had a tremendous impact on our waterways. Dams have led to the extinction of species. They've fundamentally changed the hydrology in this country, the way water moves, and not for the better. While many of them serve a purpose, they provide water supply to cities, they provide water for farmers, some generate hydropower. You know, we believe that damming a place that would flood wilderness on Castle Creek and on Maroon Creek is not the right solution to potential water supply issues in the future for the city of Aspen.
So the city of Aspen and the people who support the city keeping these conditional water rights have said that if they were to relinquish these water rights, that it would leave Castle and Maroon Creeks vulnerable. Can you explain what would happen to Castle and Maroon Creeks, or what might happen to Castle and Maroon Creeks if the city were to abandon these conditional rights?
The shorter answer is that nothing would happen to Castle and Maroon Creeks if the city were to give up these conditional water rights. What's, I think, important to understand about conditional water rights, and these conditional water rights specifically, is that they can only be used for one thing alone right now, and that is to fill a 170-foot dam on Castle Creek and a 155-foot dam on Maroon Creek. So in order for that water right to really exist, a dam on Castle Creek and a 155-foot dam on Maroon Creek, both of which would flood wilderness, they have to be constructed, they have to be filled with water, and then water has to be put to, what we say in the water world, put to beneficial use. So it has to be delivered to the city of Aspen for municipal use.
So some of the supporters of these rights have said that it would be reckless of the city to abandon these water rights without having a separate plan in place. Do you agree with that? Do you think that's true?
Well, I would suggest that no, it's not true. Conditional water right does not protect those rivers from outside entities, for example, a Front Range water provider from coming in and filing a water right. Those water rights, if the city were to walk away from them, cancel them, abandon them, they cannot be swept up by some other entity. They just go away because fundamentally that water doesn't exist because it's not being put to beneficial use. At one point, there were hundreds of conditional water rights throughout the state, and many have been abandoned in recent years by entities like the Colorado River District and Denver Water with absolutely no consequences.
Can you explain what the city will need to prove in water court to show that, to hang on to these conditional rights?
Sure. Well, their burden of proof or the standard that they're going to have to meet in water court is that they have to show the state of Colorado that they can and will build these projects unequivocally, and that they have been making over the last 6 years, that they have been making steady progress towards doing so.
What does that mean? What does steady progress mean?
Well, I think that's a good question, and it's different in every proceeding. Typically and traditionally in the state of Colorado, proving diligence has not been a very heavy lift. So when an applicant is not contested in their diligence, it's the state typically, you know, rubber stamps the diligence. But obviously, because this case is a little bit different, these are high-value rivers that many people believe should remain free-flowing, they're going to have to be more thorough in meeting that standard. And that standard, like I said, is that they have to demonstrate that they can and will build these projects. It's not that they hypothetically may need to build them in 20 years or 30 years, but they are making steady progress towards doing that. And they're going to also have to demonstrate that there is actually real demand for the water.
Do you think that they will be able to do that from what you've seen in the city's actions up until this point? Does it seem likely that they'll be able to show that they can and will?
That's an interesting question that ultimately, you know, water court will decide. But one thing that the city has done in the last year is they completed a water availability and supply report that goes out to 2064. And in that report, they determined that there is no additional need or demand for water, that the city can meet all their municipal demands with the water that they have available to them now. The city holds a significant portfolio of very senior water rights on Castle and Maroon Creek that they use for municipal water supply, of which they use just a portion of that. So that report suggests they don't need these dams. When it comes to can and will, it's going to be a challenge. One, these dams will flood wilderness, designated wilderness in the Maroon Bells Snowmass Wilderness Area. And then there's a whole other slew of permits that they need to acquire that all are going to be a challenge. Not to mention that years ago for the Castle Creek Dam, the Bureau of Reclamation came and did kind of the first part of a feasibility study, initial feasibility study to study the viability of developing a reservoir there, and found that the terrain, the geology was not adequate to support construction of a reservoir. Our interest is ensuring that wild rivers like Castle Maroon Creek remain that way, and that we don't dam them, and that we don't, kind of on a bigger scale, you know, that we don't have this as an example of how we build community resilience to climate change by throwing kind of concrete structures and water storage at it. And we don't think that's appropriate. We think that community resilience is ultimately going to depend on, you know, preserving our wild places like Castle Maroon Creek.
So, Will, you can speak to this too. If the city is concerned about providing enough water for its citizens, what are some things that it could do to ensure that we have enough water here in Aspen?
I think, well, there's part of the reasons that I think both organizations are engaged in this is because we want to see these creeks protected forever. And I mean, it's nice to know that the city seems like they feel that way too. It seems like they're a little bit misguided in their sense that conditional water rights might help with that protection. But fortunately, there's other ways to protect those creeks and make sure that no outside entity can come and build a project on them. And probably the most promising is something called an in-stream flow, which is a water right, just like any other water right, but the purpose of it is to keep water in the stream to maintain a healthy stream. Castle Maroon Creeks each have in-stream flows on them, but they're what are called base flows, so just kind of a set amount all year round. And one possibility would be to add to that in-stream flow during the springtime when there's a lot of water in the stream. That's the water that a water developer would probably target if they were going to build a project. And so you could add an in-stream flow that would protect those peak runoff flows. And so that's something that both Wilderness Workshop and I think American Rivers would love to partner with the city, maybe the county on to add that protection. And that's, you know, a much, much better guarantee of protection. There's a legal basis for it as opposed to a conditional water right, which everybody acknowledges provides no legal protection for a stream.
that would pretty much tie up those rivers and disincentivize any future water development from outside entities. So it served two purposes. It would protect the rivers from outside water development, and it would protect the environment. And I guess a third would be that it would be groundbreaking for the state of Colorado, and Aspen would be playing a direct role in improving and strengthening the state's in-stream flow program. And that's just one example. There are others as well.
That was Matt Rice from American Rivers and Will Rausch from Wilderness Workshop. To hear more details about what the city of Aspen will have to do to hold on to those water rights, go to aspenpublicradio.org.
Lifting a moratorium on development in downtown Aspen and dealing with a decades-old problem of bottleneck traffic coming into town are on the top of the to-do list for Mayor Steve Skadron. Aspen Public Radio's Carolyn Zachariasen caught up with him in the Silver Queen gondola to talk about what 2017 looks like for him and his constituents.
What do you see happening for next year?
Well, number one is finishing up this moratorium. It's a gigantic.
That's a commercial. It's a downtown core and outline areas of commercial development moratorium.
All our zones except residential. So
along Main Street too.
That's a big deal. We have to stay on schedule and work through that. We're going to go through a public comment period and finish that. Then we're going to, believe it or not, we're moving into the election season. Election topics will dominate the conversation. One of them will be the chain store issue. And I think the citizen group is putting together a roundtable discussion for the community at the Institute sometime in January. And the discussions around regulation there will be dominant in the community conversation.
The chain store ban discussion, how does the local government regulate free enterprise?
It's one of my reservations about this initiative. So one thing that has to come out in this community discussion are some review of the models that other communities are employing that the citizen group has directed us to consider. One example that's been given is the city of Sonoma. Now, I've never been to Sonoma, but apparently this ban, the chain store ban, works there. The citizen group has used that as an example. But what I don't know is what their community structure is like. They may have, I wonder if they have a historic core where they've banned stores, but they have a commercial zone around that, kind of like Boulder has, you know, adjacent to or within the proximity of the Pearl Street, you know, where you kind of have a landing zone for these chain stores. Yeah, we don't have that. So I don't know if we're talking apples to apples.
Pretend that you're not up for re-election in May. Well, if it was business as usual, what would you hope the council could get done?
I'm really, believe it or not, encouraged around our transportation problems. And we laid the foundation for kind of the next step in addressing our traffic problems. So one of the big things in 2017 I want to continue to undertake and try to put some sense of clear direction on is the entrance to Aspen situation.
That was Aspen Mayor Steve Skadron speaking with Carolyn Zachariasen.
You're listening to Mountain Edition from Aspen Public Radio News. I'm Elizabeth Stewart Severy. If you missed the first part of today's show, you can find a podcast on our website, aspenpublicradio.org. Also online, you can sign up for Aspen Public Radio's new ForkFed digital newsletter. ForkFed comes out every Friday, updating you on the week's news in the Roaring Fork Valley and beyond.
Montana State Senator Mike Phillips has been involved in efforts across the country to restore populations of wolves. He was recently involved in their reintroduction to Yellowstone National Park and is now launching the Rocky Mountain Wolf Project with a goal of bringing the apex predators back to Colorado. Elizabeth sat down with Phillips earlier this month to discuss what wolf recovery in this state could look like.
You can make a very strong case, a very science-based, informed case that what we did in Yellowstone is exactly what should be done in western Colorado. We knew from the outset that gray wolves are so very capable of settling suitable habitat that if we gave them just a chance, they would take care of the rest. And for lots of reasons, it's almost a certainty that the only way gray wolves will ever come to occupy the great wild lands of western Colorado is through reintroductions. Waiting on natural recolonization to occur is a fool's errand.
Can you explain a little bit about why? I think we have had some reports of wolves in Colorado, in northern Colorado.
Yeah, sure. No, and they've wandered through the western half of the state, but it's a small number. And one wolf on the Great Big Walkabout does not a population make. If you take a real hard, objective look at the best science that we can assemble about landscape connectivity, it's almost a certainty that not enough wolves would ever make the trip to Colorado, survive long enough to find one another, have enough puppies to give rise to a viable population. Wolves are quite capable of wandering tremendous distances, but they typically don't. So the distance doesn't help. The number of animals involved coming from the north to the south will be very, very modest. When the state of Wyoming puts in front of the federal government a wolf management plan that the federal government can accept as adequate, federal protections for gray wolves in Wyoming will go away. What the state of Wyoming is almost certainly going to do is consider the gray wolf to be a predator species. A predator designation means that you can be shot any time, day or night, any time of the year, in any numbers, and left in the field. You're vermin. The connections between Wyoming and Colorado aren't great anyway, and they're going to get fundamentally worse. So those individuals that are on a great big walkabout have to run this gauntlet that is a lousy habitat of Wyoming.
Right.
So you're not going to have a whole bunch of gray wolves drifting south out of Wyoming. They ain't going to make it. Why not take the bull by the horns, conduct a reintroduction, build a management scheme that allowed for the needs and concerns of Coloradans?
And what would we see in terms of benefits in western Colorado if we did have wolves in our landscape?
Well, from a spiritual perspective, from a moral perspective, wolves in Colorado would be the last piece of a 40-plus year restoration puzzle that we have been assembling that would result in gray wolves being reestablished all up and down the Rocky Mountains from the high Arctic to the Mexican border. More specifically, to the ecology of western Colorado, if gray wolves became common enough and were in place long enough, they could begin to add resiliency and promote the integrity of the wild landscapes of western Colorado by fundamentally killing a good number of elk and deer. That would allow for a host of beneficial effects to trickle through the food system. It's called a trophic cascade. If gray wolves are common enough for a long enough period of time, they can be great ecological engineers promoting health and diversity and resiliency. And on the flip side, there are really no profound downsides to having gray wolves in western Colorado.
Why do you think so many people have such an emotional response to wolves?
Sure. Well, I've grown convinced that gray wolves affirm the power of myths. Little Red Riding Hood is a powerful story. So to some extent, that's why, because the myth of the gray wolf is powerful. Ever since we have huddled around fires for comfort and security, we have shared stories. That's what galvanized us. And some of the stories became so powerful as myths and a glue that bound us together. And ever since then, we have not accommodated wild, self-willed nature. And the gray wolf is all about wild, self-willed nature. If you're willing to take a fair, objective look at the gray wolf, in other words, embrace a reasonable estimation of the truth about gray wolves, you know what you conclude? They're really easy to live with. They're not the devil incarnate that people imagine them to be.
That was Mike Phillips of the Rocky Mountain Wolf Project. To hear more about wolves, myths, and politics, go to aspenpublicradio.org.
Aspen High School's Circle of Friends Service Club pairs students with senior citizens. There's an annual bingo game, knitting circles, and monthly technology sessions. It happens in the form of an open house at the Pickens County Senior Center, where elders can bring any technology question or electronic device in and get schooled by the teens. Allison stopped by the gathering this month and brings us this report.
At each table, a senior citizen is surrounded by a handful of high school students. Electronic devices of all shapes and sizes are spread out in front of them.
I have everything, but I just, you know, when you do it once and you're older, it just doesn't stick.
Retiree Jane Kendall has come to the tech sessions multiple times. She recently traveled through China. Today, she's getting help organizing the photos from the trip. There are some on an iPad, some on an iPhone. The hope is to get them all together on a thumb drive and save them on the computer.
We're going to click import.
Sounds easy if you've been doing it your whole life.
They know so much, you know, and they grew up with it. I mean, in 2 seconds, she could figure out exactly what to do with all this.
Sometimes the lesson is as simple as learning which button resets a smartphone. Sometimes, says Livy Klaus, co-president of the service group, it's literally learning a new language.
There was this one gentleman, and he wanted to learn how to use emojis. He was very confused. He didn't really know if they had meanings. We told him that you kind of can interpret them however you want to, but he thought they were like a dictionary for it and a specific meaning for each emoji.
Okay, great. Kids these days are constantly clicking away on their phones, taking selfies, and speaking in a language of pictures that is up for interpretation, all of which may seem rather unimportant in the grand scheme of learning new skills. But it turns out some apps have real-world applications.
I'm not an early adapter of technology.
David Ellis attended this month to learn how to use the Downtowner transportation app. 17-year-olds Maggie McGuire and Sarah Charlin didn't even know the service existed.
Yeah, which is cool. I didn't know about it. I just learned about it. She just told me about it.
We are teaching him, but he is teaching us about cool apps.
Yeah,
it's free. Free service in town, but you have to have, as far as I know, you have to do it through your phone. You can't do it through your computer.
Barbara Bloomsma is the advisor to the high school club. She had no idea the technology training events were going to be such a big hit when they began 3 years ago.
And then we were like, oh, it'd be really wonderful if we could do technical assistance once a month. And I was like, oh, no. That's way too high of an aspiration. We'll never be able to pull it off. And the very next year, every single month.
Bloomsma says the Circle of Friends Service Club is challenging generational stereotypes.
And, you know, I hear people often say, oh, well, kids these days, they don't have manners and stuff like that. And so one of the very first ones I was walking past and I heard the high school students say to the elder, no, all caps means you're shouting. And I'm all like, there's your etiquette, you know? And so it's so great, you know, it's an exchange. It's an exchange.
And again, learning the technology is an entryway to becoming more connected all around. Senior Services Program Coordinator Mary Barber says it's a big step just getting clients in the room.
I'm seeing new faces of seniors, citizens that I've never seen before. Getting them in the door, trying to take away the mystique of a senior center. No, it's the youth center for anyone over 60. Come on.
All of the seniors at this particular session are retired. They say if they were still working, they would be able to keep up with each new advancement. Debbie Overrider has attended multiple times just to keep connected with her community.
Well, they say when you retire, there are certain things you should do, and like exercise, eat well, sleep, get your sleep, but you should be around young people. Yeah. That is an important part because you lose touch. You lose touch with youth and what they're thinking, and they're in a different world now.
It also takes some courage to show up and ask for help. After all, these are people who were masters of their craft, leaders in business, sending faxes like pros, and now feel completely left out of the loop. So it's up to seniors like Overrider to pass along the knowledge.
Yeah, my husband wouldn't come.
Yes.
I have to learn it and teach him.
For those who are brave enough, the Circle of Friends Technology Assistance Workshops are held the first Wednesday of every month at the Pickin County Senior Center.
That's all for this week's Mountain Edition. I'm Elizabeth Stewart-Sebri.
And I'm Allison Bektesh. To hear this show again or subscribe to our Mountain Edition podcast, head to our website, aspenpublicradio.org.
Tune in tomorrow at 3:30 for Valley Roundup. News director Carolyn Zachariasen talks with a panel of local journalists about the top news stories of 2016.
Thanks for listening. Mountain Edition is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.